Albert Mohler Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter. Dr. Mohler is president of the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary and one of the nation's leading theologians and cultural commentators. To get online with Dr. Mohler, call toll-free nationwide, 1-877-893-TALK. That's 1-877-893-8255. Now, here's your host, Dr. Albert Mohler.
Hello, America. Welcome to the Albert Mohler Program. You want to get 1,000 adolescents to sign a petition? How do you do that? Well, just tell them all their term papers are going to be studied by a computer to determine whether they have stolen this stuff or written it on their own. 1,000 signatures just in one high school out of protest of the school sending their papers to be checked by a firm to make certain that they aren't copying stuff whole scale out of other books and printed materials. Now, in one sense, this kind of tells you everything about what you need to know about higher education and high school education today. I have to tell you that as a professor, as well as the president of this seminary and college, this is an ongoing issue we're always having to worry about. In every generation, there are particular challenges and particular temptations. But one of the temptations of this generation is when you're assigned a term paper, go out and pull one off the net and turn it in with your cover on it. And high school students are getting caught. University students are getting caught. Graduate students are getting caught. Law students and medical students are getting caught. And now there are technologies that have been developed to help catch them. And the students are protesting. We're going to be talking about it today. And we're going to have on the CEO of one of the companies that does a lot of this screening for plagiarism and intellectual theft. It's going to be a fascinating discussion, not just about this new technology and how it has led to all kinds of opportunities to steal material, but what it says about teenagers who evidently would just as soon steal the stuff as do the work and then complain when the school says, we're going to put together a firm and a contract and a technology to catch you. We're going to be talking about this. The phone number is 877-893-8255. It is really interesting, and I have to tell you right up front, I'd love to hear from some high school and college students on this. What possible reason could you have to protest having your paper checked by one of these sources? If you're actually writing the stuff and doing the work and conducting the research, these are your words, this is your intellectual product, then what do you have to fear? And what does this say about this generation of students? The phone number, 877-893-8255, 877-893-TALK. Just several months ago on this program, we had an Episcopal priest from the far left on. It's the Reverend Edward Bacon, who is the senior minister at the All Saints Episcopal Church in Pasadena, California. And we had him on for a most unusual program because I was defending his right in his church to criticize the American government and, indeed, to criticize President George W. Bush. I was speaking on behalf of his right to do that, even as I disagree with what he had to say and even as we come from opposite ends of the theological spectrum. And, boy, do I mean that. I mean that All Saints Episcopal Church in Pasadena, California, is about as far on the left as I can imagine. I consider that church to be subversive of theological orthodoxy. I consider what comes from that pulpit to be subversive of biblical truth. But if we really believe in the freedom of religion, then we believe in the freedom of the pulpit. And that means we believe in the freedom of those who agree with me to speak and the freedom of those who would oppose everything that I believe. If we really believe in this, then we have to be concerned when the Internal Revenue Service has threatened to bring legal action to revoke the tax-exempt status of this major church in Pasadena, California. When the church did nothing in terms of endorsing a candidate, the church did nothing in terms of printing up bills either to say, support Kerry or to defeat Bush, but instead from the pulpit, the minister who was then preaching simply let forth a very clear declaration of his interpretation of how these events are to be understood from his pulpit. And he spoke of this in very clear terms that I have to admit I find disagreeable. But I can't find them in violation of the U.S. Constitution. Now, what makes this interesting today is that today was the day of decision for All Saints Episcopal Church in Pasadena. They either had to turn over a very large number of documents and information items to the IRS or risk being hauled into court for further action. And the vestry, that is the governing body of the All Saints Episcopal Church in Pasadena, California, has decided to defy the IRS and to throw the whole issue into court and to try to make its case that the IRS, through its investigation, is conducting an unconstitutional intrusion into the life of a local congregation. Now, let me tell you what you're going to find on this that's going to be very interesting. First of all, this is on page A15, front section of the New York Times today. It's going to be further and further toward the front of the paper in coming days as these legal proceedings go forward. And you're going to find something else very interesting. You're going to find liberals and conservatives standing together in a great deal of concern about this. You're going to find evangelicals standing along theological liberals on this, saying it is the right of the pulpit to declare biblical truth, and it is not the right of any governmental agency to review that. Now, the 1954 enabling legislation for the Internal Revenue Service inserted a statement that was required by then Senate Majority Leader Lyndon Baines Johnson, that the IRS would revoke the tax exemption of any religious organization that interfered in a political campaign. That was because then-Senator Johnson was being harassed by some religious radio stations in his home state of Texas. The problem is that immediately throws the entire issue into the subjectivity of federal agents. What is or is not an intrusion? Lacking any clear indication from Congress as to what that is, the Internal Revenue Service is now, according to the Wall Street Journal and their own declaration, now going to be listening to sermons to decide whether there is too much political content. That is genuinely scary. Having government agents listen to what goes on in the pulpits of a nation is scary. Knowing that there are people who may be listening to CDs and tapes just in order to find out, with no prior complaint, with no prior concern, just to listen to see if there might be any unwarranted political content, that is scary. I will be the first to say that the pulpit of the church should be the place where the scripture is expounded and where the gospel is declared, not primarily in any sense about politics, but the gospel itself has political ramifications. Just to speak about righteousness and justice is essentially and inherently political in some aspect. Otherwise, it would be disconnected from the lives that we live. But as much as I believe that Bible and gospel content is to be central in the pulpit, I must resist any federal intrusion to tell me what that is in the first place. And if it's good for the evangelical, it is also good for the All Saints Episcopal Church in Pasadena, California. And that's why you're going to see a very strange coalition develop on this one very important court case. Archbishop Desmond Tutu, made famous for his fight against apartheid in South Africa, now in retirement, has declared that he is ashamed of the Anglican Church's conservative position that rejected gay priests. The reason I want to bring this to your attention is because we as Christians need to be very careful to understand something that is of vital importance. There are certain category errors we can make in our thinking. One of those errors is to believe that just because a person is right on issue A, that he must be also right on issue B. That's something we have to really watch. Now, if a person is operating out of the right worldview and is consistent, then we ought to be able to trust that the position on issue one is going to be connected, at least consistently, with the position on issue B or issue two. But that's not always the case. And the evidence here is that, for instance, Archbishop Desmond Tutu was right to oppose apartheid. He was right when he claimed that it is fundamentally wrong and unjust to treat persons of one race completely differently than the persons of another race. We should understand that. We should condemn what he condemned, and we should be embarrassed to know that there are civilizations, including our own, which have practiced their own forms of apartheid in times past. But just because someone is right on that issue does not mean they're right on every other issue. And in this case, Archbishop Desmond Tutu has come out as a proponent of homosexual rights. He says he's embarrassed by the Anglican Communion's uproar over the appointment and consecration of an openly gay bishop in the United States. He says this, and this is his spokesman saying, he found it a little short of outrageous that church leaders should be obsessed with issues of sexuality in the face of the challenges of AIDS and global poverty. Well, there you have a very clear statement of confusion. By the way, there is a second category error in our thinking. Just because issue A is important and issue B is important, to give attention to issue A is not to slight issue B. I hear this all the time. For instance, there are newspaper headlines all over the country this week about supposedly evangelical moderates deciding to expand the discussion beyond abortion and homosexuality. Let me tell you, when you see that, it is almost always not an expansion. It's a replacement. It's a way of saying, I don't want to talk about abortion and homosexuality. I want to talk about poverty and racism and income tax issues and all the rest. I must be the first to say that abortion and homosexuality are not the only issues facing the Christian church and facing the conscience of the American people. I would embrace and affirm those who say we need to broaden our concern to other issues as well. I share concern about many other issues, but we need to be honest. And what is generally meant by so many who try to make that argument is that we want to stop talking about abortion and homosexuality because those on the evangelical left are simply embarrassed by those conservative evangelicals who say we believe that the issues of human dignity and the right ordering of human sexuality are issues we simply can't ignore and about which we cannot be silent. Folks, things are confused just about everywhere. A new poll is out saying that in Scotland, 33% of residents believe that prostitution is wrong, only 33%. And almost half say that adultery is not a sin. Folks, we can't just talk about abortion and homosexuality. We got to expand it to everything because the Scripture does. We'll be right back. This is the Albert Mohler Program. Folks, you know the drill. The beginning of every semester, the beginning of every academic year, what does every student want to know? How much am I going to have to read and how much am I going to have to write? Where is that term paper? When is it due? And you know that frightening, very frightening, dawning awareness that comes when it's just days or hours away. For a lot of students, unfortunately, it's hours. And all of a sudden, they have to scramble to put all this together. And they're supposed to have been working on all their research cards. And they're supposed to have been in the library doing all this work. And they're supposed to be ready to express in their own words and argumentation a critical engagement with the question, with the text, with the issue, and then to set it forth in either an essay or a term paper or a research document, whatever the format. And increasingly, there has arisen the fact that many of these students simply aren't doing the work. Some of them are simply going to the internet, pulling down papers, or they're hiring someone who will do that similarly for them. And some of them also are very, very lax in the use of published sources. And so they'll go to books and just copy out vast segments, paragraphs right out of the book, giving no attribution and with no engagement or adequate citation. Now, the interesting thing about this is that, of course, an industry will now arise around such a problem to offer a solution. A company by the name of Turnitin, headed by CEO John Barry, Dr. John Barry, has come up with a way to use a vast database to try to match words and sequencing in order to identify, illegitimate academic work. Now, I find that very interesting, and as a matter of fact, this is an ongoing problem. It's not new. It's just new in terms of how pervasive the problem is, because the Internet and other technologies have made plagiarism and academic misconduct a lot easier to get away with. But thanks to companies like Turnitin, they're also a lot easier to be caught. Now, what prompts today's program and this discussion is that students are rebelling. Washington Post story just this morning, McLean High School in suburban Washington, D.C. Over 1,100, almost 1,200 students have put their signatures on a petition against the use of the service. They claim that it's stealing their intellectual property. The bottom line is they don't want to get caught. And with us on the program today is Dr. John Barry, the founder of Turnitin and iThenticate, which has to do with catching people in academic misconduct. Dr. Barry, welcome to the program.
Thank you for the invitation.
I hope I described accurately what you and your company are about. Why in the world would you get so many adolescents in McLean, Virginia, so upset?
Well, yeah, the one alteration I'd make to your description is that our technology is less about catching students cheating and more about deterring students from cheating and more about best practices.
Now, that's what all parents say, by the way, but go ahead.
I think that the number one reason that the students at that high school may have gotten upset is primarily due to a misunderstanding of our technology. I mean, it really should be understood that we have more than 6,000 institutional clients in more than 90 countries. We receive over 70,000 student term papers every single day. The usage of our services doubling every year. In a couple of months, as the fall term gets underway, we should be receiving over 100,000 student term papers every single day. And our renewal rate's over 95%. And the take-home message there is that it's here to stay. You know, there aren't legal problems. There aren't ethical problems with the use of Turnitin. And I really do believe it boils down to a misunderstanding of what Turnitin is all about and how it works.
Well maybe so, Dr. Barry, but I got to tell you, I have to say, as an educator myself, my guess is they just don't want to get caught. Quite frankly, when you're looking at the fact that Duke University indicates from a study that at least 60% of students have admitted plagiarizing at some point, stealing material, you're looking at a very pervasive problem. If it were not so pervasive, you wouldn't have any clients, right?
You're right. I mean, that's a really good point, and I really try to make an effort to assume that most students are working hard to make the grade. Most students are not cheating. But with that said, you're right. There are a significant minority of students who would not like to get caught. But you know, when it comes to passing around a petition against what we do, I think you could also successfully pass around a petition asking for, you know, a 2-hour school day instead of an 8-hour school day. You really got to think about what's going on here.
Yeah, well, actually, I'm with you right there. We don't do educational administration by petition drive.
I think it's a good thing.
Yeah, I would say so, especially when you look at high school students. And that's no insult to high school students. It's just to say that, look, there are certain academic requirements. Interestingly, one of the students that was interviewed by the Washington Post said, and I'm going to quote, "It's like if you searched every car in the parking lot or drug tested every student," end quote. Why is it not that, Dr. Berry?
Well, number one, it's not that because I guarantee you that was not my purpose when I created Turnitin. And as somebody who did his undergraduate at Berkeley and his PhD at UC Berkeley, I'm probably one of the most liberal guys you'll ever meet. I think the better analogy for Turnitin is sort of like the proctor in the SAT exam or the referee on the football field. The presence of a referee is not to imply that your athletes are cheating. The presence of the referee is to try to make sure that everybody is playing on a level playing field. I don't think that the interpretation of Turnitin should be equated to, you know, a presumption of guilt on behalf of the teachers. Because, again, I guarantee you, the vast majority of our clients don't want to catch anybody cheating. Our clients want to primarily do one thing, or two things, and that is to deter the problem and to just improve education. In fact, we recommend to all of our clients that at least on the first time of finding a student who has not cited their work properly, that you give them the benefit of the doubt. You assume that they didn't know how to properly cite. You make it into an educational moment, and you show them how to properly do research and how to properly write a term paper. Everybody wins there.
Okay, Dr. Berry, we want everybody to win, and I need for our listening audience to get a clear handle on really kind of what's going on here. How many papers do you catch?
Well, it's interesting. You put the plagiarism rate by the largest study of cheating in the world, at somewhere around 60%. Of the more than 70,000 papers we receive every single day, about 30% of those papers are less than original.
Okay, you got parents and educators having heart attacks all over America with that. That's almost one out of three in some way being illegitimate. In other words, you're catching almost one out of three.
Well, I mean, think about it this way. Of the 70,000, we're finding about 21,000 papers a day being less than original, and that should concern people. And this is why it should concern people, because you can have the best textbooks, you can have the best instructors, and you can have the best schools on the face of this earth, but if your students aren't doing their own work, none of that matters. And that is why originality in work is the most fundamental aspect of education.
Okay, thank you. Our guest today has been Dr. John Berry, who is the CEO of Turnitin and iThinicate. Mr. Berry, Dr. Berry, thank you for coming on the program today. Folks, I want you to join the conversation by calling 877-893-8255. That's 877-893-TALK. Dr. Berry just landed a big bomb on us here. When I asked him the question, I didn't know how he was going to answer it. 70,000 plus papers turned in every day. What percentage? I thought, what, 5, 10, 15% are going to come back? 30% every day. 21,000 illegitimate term papers, research papers, who knows, maybe even doctoral dissertations being turned in every single day. Almost 1,200 students at McLean High School in suburban Washington, D.C. signed a petition protesting this. I wonder how many of them have turned in papers that either were caught or would have been caught. Folks, there are a lot of issues here, and I realize for some of you out there, you're saying, what does this have to do with me? You know, whether a term paper is was stolen material or not, these are your future doctors and educators and ministers and future heart surgeons and judges and all the rest. Are we institutionalizing academic fraud and lying and misrepresentation among the young, and why are they so concerned that they might get caught at it? The phone number, 877-893-8255, 877-893-TALK. We'll be right back with your conversation and your thoughts. I'm Albert Mohler.
listening to the Albert Mohler Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter. To get online, call toll-free 1-877-893-TALK. That's 1-877-893-8255. Or go to www.albertmohler.com. Here again is your host, Dr. Albert Mohler.
Welcome back to the program. The issue is academic misconduct, plagiarism. That's a crime that many of you have never even heard about, because the word is very specific to the academic environment, where intellectual property is stolen. You take someone else's words as if they were your own. You take someone else's research as if it were your own. Present it as if you have done the research and written the words. It's a huge problem across American academic life, and it starts really early. That's why this story in the Washington Post today isn't about college or graduate students. It's about high school students who are protesting having their papers screened by a commercial firm in order to determine the illegitimate use of this kind of material. The phone number, 877-893-8255. That's 877-893-TALK. Patiently waiting on the line in Asheville, North Carolina, is J.C., listening on WFGW. Go ahead, J.C.
Hi, Dr. Mohler. How are you?
I'm doing great. Glad to hear from you, and thanks for waiting.
Not a problem. I'm a student at the University of North Carolina at Asheville, and I mean, I wholeheartedly agree that, you know, measures should be taken to protect intellectual property. And, you know, I know at our university we have an academic code of conduct which clearly states, you know, you're not allowed to plagiarize, and if you get caught doing so, there are consequences for the actions, including expulsion from the university. But at the same time, I think it's important to note that just in listening to the dialogue, Dr. Berry was saying that 30% of the term papers submitted were less than original. That's not necessarily to imply that 30% are plagiarizing. I mean, maybe only 5% are actual straight plagiarism. And just from knowing what I know from my peer group, you know, there's a lot of people that do not know how to effectively write a term paper, research paper, and properly cite sources. So, I mean, this could be a great diagnostic tool for improving the educational system and to, you know, support research and learning on your own. And, I mean, I think it would be a real shame to turn this into kind of a fear-mongering kind of thing of 30% of the nation's kids are plagiarizing. I think that would be a very big injustice.
Oh, it could be, J.C. However, 60% admitted to some form of academic misconduct in the Duke University study, which is the largest study ever done. Certainly, we don't want to send parents, running into their kids' bedrooms in order to ransack term papers over against the Encyclopedia Britannica. But we do want to make persons aware this is a problem. We live in a fallen world, and we expect the sinners will sin. That's why we have policemen who write tickets on the highway. That's why we have fences around the jail. And J.C., I appreciate your point. You say you don't object to this, and you're right. It's not all whole-scale plagiarism. Some of it is more minor, but still, that's significant. And, I can just tell you as an educator myself, you always have to worry about stuff. You have to worry, is this really the student's product? Is this really the kind of work you're looking for? And that's true all across America in all kinds of colleges, universities, high schools, and the rest. Thanks for your call, J.C. Let's go to Andrew, listening on XM 170, calling from Kingston, New York. Go ahead, Andrew.
Hi, thanks for having my call. Great conversation you're having today. You know, one of the things that I hear, I'm an educational technologist, and I work at the college level and also with high school teachers. And one of the things I do hear is about Turnitin also collects all of the papers of whoever the students that are submitted. So basically a lot of students sometimes have issues with the fact that what is happening with their own intellectual property, what is happening with their own information that's being submitted to this database and is now stored there.
Yeah, and my understanding is that there can be no continued use in terms of publication or anything, but the database is put in this vast tank, you might say, Andrew. As I understand it, correct me if I'm wrong, and that tank is then used as a basis for evaluating other papers to see if the same writing shows up again and again. Isn't that right?
I believe that is what happens. Yeah, I know,
yeah.
But that's a misconception that with the students that they also oftentimes think that their information is going into this database and can then be pooled and researched and used in other purposes.
Yeah.
So that's kind of, I bet that is probably what's happening in the Greenville incident, where they think that their information is being, you know, housed someplace and being used for something else.
Yeah, it's being used for comparison to make sure that it doesn't show up again and again. And, Andrew, you know, you make a point, intellectual property. I think there are a lot of listeners out there saying, you know, what in the world is that? Well, if you write a book, you have the rights to the royalty from that book. If you create a television show, you have the rights to the income from that television show. If you hold the copyright on something, that's a matter of intellectual property. And if you write a paper, it ought to be yours, and it ought to be basically at your disposal other than its academic use. Andrew, you raise a very good point. Let me say this. I think that it would be wrong for a school to use a service like this without telling students ahead of time. I think it would be wrong to use such a service like this surreptitiously. I think a school needs to be right up front and say, hey, if you willingly enter our school and if you willingly take this course, you're going to forfeit, you know, your right to disallow the use of your paper in this way. And I think that's right up front and very honest. But we ought to be alarmed by what we're hearing here. Be right back. Welcome back to the Albert Mueller Program. This is very interesting. There is a big debate out there about students who are turning in work that is not their own. And for intelligent Christian conversation, the issue is this. Why should we protest a system that should aim for making all persons accountable? In the same way that we have no right to protest the fact that we have interstate highways and we have traffic laws and we have people to watch them. We don't protest when we know that there are planes with radar flying overhead. We may not want to get caught, but we do understand that in a constitutional regime of laws and a system of orderly principles and regulations, that we need some police force out there. We know this, and Dr. Barry of this company, Turnitin, said, look, you know, it's kind of like having a referee on the field. I think it's a little more than that. I'm not sure that that's an adequate metaphor or illustration for this, because it's kind of like having someone watching you while you're on the field all the time, not just one referee for the whole field, but someone watching virtually everyone. And, you know, who could protest that? Well, some students in McLean, Virginia protested that, 1,200 signing a petition against it. I have to say, I think part of this is just an adolescent protest against the man, against the administration and the regime. But I think the other thing is that students recognize that these new technologies mean they're almost surely to get caught. Academic misconduct's not a new thing, but the Internet has offered new opportunities both for the misconduct and for catching it. The phone number is 877-893-8255. That's 877-893-TALK. Let's go to Fayetteville, North Carolina, where Denisha's on the line, listening on XM-170. Go ahead, Denisha.
Hey, Dr. Mueller. Thanks for taking my call. I am an administrator at a university and teach a couple of courses every now and then, and I know that academic dishonesty is a huge issue and something I worry about. But something else I worry about is, not to be negative about all of my students, but a lot of times it is truly that they just don't know how to correctly cite things or how to avoid plagiarism, but they also just don't really care. They don't want to take the time. It does take a lot of time and effort to properly cite things, and they don't really want to take that time and put that work into their papers a lot of times, and I find that very frustrating sometimes. And, of course, that's not all of my students, but I have encountered that, and I wonder if that is not almost as big of an issue sometimes as the cheating is, that we have students who just don't want time to do things correctly.
Well, I think sometimes they go together, don't they, Denisha? We got a lot of, overnight wonders turned in academia, where students wait till the last minute and stay up all night writing something just to hand it in. And that something, usually done at the last minute like that, either is substandard in terms of quality, or in a lot of cases, it just includes stolen material. Let me ask you, as both an administrator and as a faculty member and teacher, how much of this do you find among your students?
Well, I haven't used systems like Turnitin. You know, it's usually been things I just kind of can catch on my own. It does not happen a whole lot, but when it does happen, it's usually pretty large scale. It's a pretty, you know, serious example. Where I can, like, go to the web and do a search and find something precisely from a paper on a website somewhere that someone else has written and things like that. And,
yeah.
And it's happened several times, but it's certainly the majority of students don't do that, but again, it's the ones who do and do it big that you get concerned about.
Very good point, Denisha. I didn't mean to cut you off there, but that is a very good point. And I want to say this to the parents who are out there. You got a high school student. I'm not going to plant seeds of suspicion in your mind about his or her academic misconduct any more than I'd tell you to worry that they're using drugs or anything else. But you are parents, and you are put there by God as those to hold your own children accountable and to guide them and teach them. And we do want to know what's going on in our kids' lives. Let me tell you one thing you can do. You can take a term paper written by your teenager, and you can just take out a paragraph or two and put it in Google and see what comes up once you search. If you put quotation marks around, say, a sentence or two, if it shows up elsewhere, it'll show up that way. And I'm telling you, you may be surprised what you find. Some of it may not be absolutely premeditated, you know, theft of the material. Some of it just may be sloppy citation. But in any event, you might learn something. And the search engine can be put to a whole new use. How many kids out there are afraid right now of being Googled? That's a strange thought. The phone number, 877-893-8255, 877-893-TALK. What would happen if your last term paper got put into a search engine? Where else might it show up? Let's go to Louisville, Kentucky, where Michael's on the line listening on WFIA. Go ahead, Michael.
Yes, sir, Dr. Mueller. Nice to have you talking to me today. I certainly agree with the use of the program. The pursuit of an education is involving higher order thinking, earning a bachelor's, master's, doctoral degree, what have you, should demonstrate that you are able to undertake higher order thinking tasks, and the involvement with cheating and not citing sources properly does not at all involve the true philosophy of education.
So you're saying copying stuff out of a book doesn't amount to research?
Certainly not. A mouse can hit a button on a computer and include a statement that is that was already drawn up by another person just as well as a human can.
Very, very good point. I appreciate your call, Michael. That is a good point. Cheating is just not consistent with the aims of education. That's very important. What we're looking at here is thinking, not just the ability to copy out of a book. Almost anyone can do that. But the ability to think through the material, recast it with your own thought and analysis. Let's go to Richard calling from Melbourne, Florida, listening on XM170. Go ahead, Richard.
Hi, Dr. Mueller. I've appreciated your program. I've listened for quite some time. And the
Thank
point
you.
that you're raising now strikes me as being one that I want to ask a question about. Shouldn't we think about this this system that's proposed as simply an extension or a tool in the hands of the educator?
Yeah, and that's a very good point. And, Richard, that's one of the reasons why I said I think you need to tell people up front this kind of thing is going to be used, and you do need to make it a part not only of catching people who misbehave, but of telling persons right up front, look, you're going to have to be very careful in citing your sources. We're going to teach you how to do this because, you know, your lack of citation is going to be caught. And there should be, if not some kind of penalty as if it's dishonest, there ought at least to be the academic penalty for work that is not well done. You know, as when I, in the classroom, make a requirement for someone to write a paper, I'm really looking to see their engagement with the issue. But in order for me to know what they think and for it to be academically credible, they're going to have to cite their sources. They're going to have to be meticulous in their use of quotations. And they're going to have to avoid paraphrasing. Instead, I want direct quotations where there's a quotation. And then I want significant reflective analysis where they're thinking on their own. And that's a big point. Richard, I appreciate so much your call from Melbourne, Florida. This ought to be something that is seen, I think, no matter the company. I have no commercial interest in any of these companies. And, you know, frankly, there's a non-commercial service available out there. Then congratulations to them, too. The point is, it's a good thing that we're all held accountable with what we write and what we say. We'll be right back. Welcome back. Just some final thoughts here. You know, as Christians thinking about something like this, I want to turn this to the whole question of technology, because that is a big issue for us. Jacques Ellul, one of the most significant Christian thinkers of the last century, said that every technology brings new opportunities for human sin, as well as new opportunities for the human imagination. And that's certainly true here. This new technology has brought new opportunities. No one could get arrested for a speeding ticket on an interstate that didn't exist without cars. The invention of the automobile brought all kinds of things, good things, but also brought the opportunity for people to, you know, more speedily get away from a bank robbery, to do all kinds of bad things, vehicular homicide, drunk driving. In other words, technologies are never morally neutral. They come inherent with certain things that can be done that we all recognize ought not to be done. One of the things that has come with the technology of the internet is that it has put at our disposal, really at the very click of our fingertips, an enormous amount of data that can be used for good or for ill. And some of that data is itself poisonous, pornographic, violent, insidious, dangerous. Now, those who say the answer to this is simply to pull the computer out of the house better be pulling everything else out of the house, too, starting with electrical wires and the telephone. Telephone can be used to say good things, positive things, God-honoring things, or for perversity, death threats, pornography. All that to say that with the use of a technology, we as Christians better think carefully about how our lives and discipleship are impacted by this technology and how we have, as Christians, a unique responsibility. The Apostle Paul in Philippians told us that we should aspire to the good, the beautiful, and the true. And when it comes to our use of any technology, whether it's a car or a plow or a knife or a wedge or the internet or a search engine, had better be to try to aspire to do the best things rather than the worst things, to aspire to the most beautiful, the most good, the most true things. And that means in our use of information and all the rest, we have to be very careful to be good stewards of the opportunity that has been given us. When it comes to the internet, the computer, once again, I just have to say to America's parents, realize you will either control the computer or the computer will quickly control your household. You had better determine what you're going to allow in terms of your teenager's access to the computer, to internet search engines, to surfing the web, to the instant messaging and all the rest. But realize that when our students go to college, they face all kinds of temptations, not only in terms of the material on the internet, but how to use the internet somehow to even get around some academic work and all the rest. Folks, this just reminds us that in a sinful world, we will invent new ways to sin all the time. What I hope this program has helped illustrate today is that one of the symptoms of a sinful society is a resistance to getting caught. That ought to tell us a whole lot from a Christian worldview perspective about what the old Puritans used to call the deadly sinfulness of sin. We'll be back next week with Intelligent Christian Conversation. I'll meet you then.
Thanks for listening, and be sure to visit our website, www.albertmohler.com. You'll find archives of past shows and other important resources. You can also email your questions and comments. That's www.albertmohler.com. Be sure to join us next time for the Albert Mohler Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter.